sports.com/radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up during last year's presidential campaign and now in the 13 months since the election, right-wing speakers and groups have become more emboldened in America, from the violence in Charlottesville to white nationalist Richard Spencer's speech in Gainesville in October, to the increased visibility of KKK and neo-Nazi groups. The far right has come out of the shadows. After the defeat of Nazis during World War II and the defeat of the Ku Klux Klan by the nonviolent civil rights movement, the far right laid low here in the U.S., emerging only from time to time. Our next guest says that these ultra-conservative groups, groups like Posse Comitatus, the Patriots, the KKK, and the Minutemen, never really went away. Rather, they evolved into a new generation of groups, from the Tea Party, Three Percenters, and the Knights Party, to law enforcement-focused groups like the CSPOA and the Oath Keepers. Banded together, they've rebranded as the alt-right. Our guest is author David Neewert. He examines the alt-right in his new book, Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. I spoke with David Neewert last week. David Neewert, welcome to WMNF. Thanks for coming back on the radio station.
It's a pleasure to be back, Rob.
I want to ask you about the definition of alt-right in your book, Alt-America. How do you define alt-right?
Well, the alt-right really is a pretty new phenomenon that just has popped up, I would say, really significantly in the last 3 years. Its origins are back in 2009 and thereabouts. And it's originally was in purely online phenomenon and has now started spreading to the real world. If I had to describe it as a movement, I would describe it as white nationalism rewired for the 21st century. It's not just a rebranding. These folks have a very different approach. This is not your grandfather's Klan. They use technology in very sophisticated fashion. They are very culturally aware. They use irony and humor and things like that. Even if it's disgusting, transgressive humor, it's still very much a different kind of approach than what we've typically seen from the radical right over the last 50 years, which was always a very backward-looking thing that, you know, wanted to go take us back to, you know, some golden age of white supremacy. And ultimately, that's what these guys want too, but they do it in a very sort of forward-leaning way, especially by, like I say, leveraging modern technology as well as pop culture. And really, they're geared towards recruiting young white males between the ages of 16 and 30.
Now, there's a lot of streams in this. Do they all have the same aim?
No, there are a lot of streams. There's a lot of elements within it. Some of them are specifically misogynist, anti-feminist elements within it. And this is particularly the case with people who were recruited into the movement through the video gaming culture, which is we're seeing a significant amount of. As well as, you know, there are nativist elements that don't really have a lot to do with the gamers. And likewise, outright, you know, neo-Nazis who want to march down the street chanting blood and soil. You know, there are a lot of different elements in it, but they're all what's actually the congealing element, the thing that's brought them all together more than anything. This is Donald Trump.
What is it about Donald Trump that attracts all these various groups?
They see him as a leader. They see him as the person who's going to change the political scene and, you know, change politics in America in a way that's hospitable to them and their ideology. None of them really see Trump as himself a member of the alt-right, but rather as the person whose cause they can all rally around.
Now, a lot of this is through dog whistle politics. President Trump himself denies that he's encouraging these people or he's embracing them. He says it, you know, essentially is a smear against him and his followers to say that he's encouraging this far-right activity. But at the same time, I think you and others who study this would say that there's a bit of a dog whistle going on, a frequency that many people can't hear.
Well, you'll notice that his denials have all been very anodyne, very low level, not particularly, you know, loud. He doesn't make a lot of fuss about it. And instead, he just rather quickly says, well, I disavow them. And that sort of thing. And these guys all uniformly interpret that as, well, he's just doing what he has to do as a politician to survive. We understand that. What's important to them is the signals that he gives beforehand when he, for instance, at that press conference when he said, well, some of them are very fine people.
After Charlottesville.
After Charlottesville. And those are the signals that they hear and that they pay attention to. And he can deny this all he likes, but he is yet to have actually confronted this very harsh reality that there are people out there who are not only marching in the street carrying neo-Nazi banners and chanting his name, which happened in Charlottesville, but there are people out there chanting his name and shouting his name at minorities when they commit hate crimes. We've had a real rash of that with people yelling Trump as they're assaulting people who are Muslim or gay or whatever. And we've also gotten this spate of graffiti, hate crimes, vandalizations that reference Trump and his rhetoric, such as swastikas put on buildings that say, with the graffiti that says, make America white again, a direct reference to Trump's main slogan. And those are the kinds of things that he has never, ever even come close to confronting. And this is why the problem continues.
We're talking with Dave Neiwirth about his new book, Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. To what extent was the appointment of Steve Bannon to a position in the White House, was that important to these alt-right groups to say Trump is one of them, or at least Trump tacitly supports their cause?
Yes, it was definitely part of the sort of solidification process. The event that really attracted, that sort of put all of these people uniformly in Trump's camp was when in, I think it was August of 2015, he announced his immigration proposal. And his immigration proposal was, or, you know, his immigration plan at that time, you know, that early one was essentially everything that David Duke had been asking for the previous 20 years. So they were ecstatic when he released that. And this is when we saw all of these organizations jumping on board the Trump bandwagon and all of these sort of ideological leaders as well, you know, from Richard Spencer to Andrew Anglin to the guys at Occidental Descent. You know, Brad Griffin. And so this was part of that was the key element. But then he would do things like he would tweet out fake black crime statistics that had been put together by the Council of Conservative Citizens, and actually originally posted. The thing that he retweeted was right from a neo-Nazi account on Twitter. And those are the kind of signals that they see as him being part of the deal. And then when he named Bannon his campaign manager, that was just, that sealed the deal for them. That was like, okay, he's definitely one of ours, or he's definitely on our side.
You start the book by talking about that announcement that President Trump is running for president, and then he talks about putting up a wall and banning Mexicans from coming to the U.S. And Dylann Roof, this white racist, goes into a church in Charleston, a Mother Emanuel church, and guns down 9 people. Was that at the same, just days after President Trump announced his candidacy?
It was the very next day. It was the very next day.
And you see a connection?
Well, I see it as a coincidence. There's no evidence that Roof was inspired by Trump or anything like that. You know, as far as we know, he was not a Trump fan before he, at the time that he went in and did that. Apparently he is now.
You mean now in prison he is a Trump fan?
Yeah, well, he's apparently made remarks hoping that, you know, the white nationalists, after a few years, will come and rescue him from prison because Trump's president. So I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that's the story I've heard from his the folks in Charleston. But yeah, the connection isn't anything on the surface. It's all much deeper than that. In that they both were these major events in signaling that there's been a major tide in American politics, or a major shift in the tide in American politics, and that now white supremacy is, you know, really bubbling up, and it's you know, this is, to me, was a sign that, you know, both were signs on the ground. That is, what Roof did was what we see happening on the ground, which is all these outbreaks of various kinds of hate crimes and these really ugly acts being performed by people who feel that they have permission to act now. And then it's happening at the same time we're seeing up at the top these major leaders who are the ones they're getting those signals from.
Now, Roof wanted to start a race war. He's a young guy. Where does Roof get his ideology from? By killing these nine members of this African-American church in Charleston, he intends to get other people to copy what he's doing. As a young guy, where did he get that ideology?
Well, that's longtime white supremacist stuff. When I was first doing this reporting back in the late 1970s and early 80s, one of the main tracks that went around was a book called The Turner Diaries, written by a man named William Pierce. And The Turner Diaries was really about a guy who was starting a race war by, among other things, blowing up the FBI building in New York. And then they hang all the race traitors on what they call a day of the rope and that sort of thing. It really kind of frightening and disturbing novel. It inspired Timothy McVeigh. It was one of Timothy McVeigh's favorite books. And it's been affiliated with a number of white supremacist terrorist acts, and it's been part of that ideology for a very long time. But interestingly, Roof is really in many ways the apotheosis of the alt-right phenomenon, in that he was almost entirely radicalized online, and which is something we're starting to see a lot of now, that these guys are being drawn into these movements by what they read online. They're not joining organizations. They're not hanging out with skinheads or militiamen or any of these other organizations that traditionally is how people were recruited into these ideologies. Rather, that he's just picking all of this stuff up entirely online. He spent a lot of time hanging out at the neo-Nazi website Stormfront, as well as reading material at the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a white supremacist organization that dates back to the old white citizens councils of the 50s and 60s for its origins. And that's where he's getting these ideas. He got, very interestingly, the fake black crime statistics that Trump tweeted out were from the exact same source that Dylann Roof read, the Council of Conservative Citizens. That was their original sourcing, which actually, and both of those sources got theirs originally from an infamous white nationalist named Jared Taylor, who wrote a book, a screed back in 1999 called The Color of Crime, that first invented these statistics. And so Trump would tweet these things out. Of course, he did this after Roof's rampage, but those were the same statistics that made Dylann Roof believe that he needed to go kill black people.
All right, so give us an example. When you say that these are fake black crime statistics, what do they say and what's the reality?
Oh, one of the things that they said was, for instance, 84% of all homicides of white people are committed by black people, which is just exactly the reverse of reality, that something like 84% of all white homicides are committed by white people, in fact. And that's just one of many of the statistics that they would throw out. But yeah, I mean, and Roof believed this stuff, that black people were killing white people in large numbers and were responsible for the deaths of white people. And so he needed to start a race war to bring an end to that.
We're talking with David Neiwirth. His new book is called Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Roof is not alone in attacking liberals or liberal church groups in order to try to start a race war. How common is it that liberals or African-Americans or progressive churches might be targeted as a way to try to get the right to rise up against the enemy, its enemy?
Well, it's happened several times. The most notorious was back in 2008 when Jim David Adkison went on a rampage in a Unitarian church in Knoxville, Tennessee. And he only succeeded in killing two people before he was wrestled to the ground. But he left behind a manifesto very similar to Roof's. And when they went to his home, in the manifesto, he said, yeah, this is a hate crime. I hate liberals, and I want to kill as many of them as we can. And I think everybody should kill as many liberals as they can. And when they went to his home, his library was full of books by, you know, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Michael Savage. So that tells you where he's getting this stuff.
So you write that in much of the public imagination, Adkison's and Roof's rampages were isolated incidents, but you go on to say that in reality, however, they were key manifestations of a larger, more disturbing phenomenon, one which has been ignored or even actively discounted by elected officials and the mainstream media, that is right-wing domestic terrorism. I think if you ask the average American, they would say, well, we're most under siege by extremist Muslims, and then maybe left-wingers, and then right-wing terrorism is way down the list. What's the reality?
Well, the reality is that by an almost 2-to-1 margin, right-wing extremist domestic terrorist acts outnumber Islamist terrorist domestic terrorist acts in this country. But, you know, so I put together a database, a definitive database that we published at Reveal News earlier this summer. That really, it took me 5 years to put this database together. And it tracked domestic terrorist acts between January 2008 and December 2016. And the numbers were something like we had 116 right-wing extremist domestic terrorist acts in that time span, compared to about 60 Islamist terrorist acts. And then left-wing terrorist acts are just insignificant. They're down. There were, I think, 19 cases of that. And so that just tells you how much more often this stuff happens. But it's always brushed under the carpet. And in fact, a lot of times, a lot of these cases that clearly fell within, you know, we use the as our criterion for determining whether or not a case fell into the database was the FBI's definition of domestic terrorism, which has about four components to it. And so we went through case by case and very carefully sifted through and made sure that each case actually was domestic terrorism. And yeah, I mean, even Dylan Roof, you know, there was some discussion as to whether or not his act was a case of domestic terrorism, and it couldn't have been any clearer, really, that it was. And it's kind of astonishing to me that it's not considered such. Well, and you know, an example of the sort of skew that happens is on the very day that Representative Peter King of New York chaired a hearing in 2012 on domestic terrorism in the House, and he made it very clear that he wasn't going to include right-wing extremist domestic terrorism at all in their considerations, that they were only going to look at Islamist cases. And he says, I've checked with the Attorney General. There's been no cases of right-wing domestic terrorism of any significance, blah, 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 blah. And just the day before he said that, the FBI had arrested a man out in northeastern Washington for leaving a backpack bomb on the parade route of the Martin Luther King parade 2 months earlier in Spokane, Washington.
David, do you think that the media and do you think law enforcement or even the executive branch of the White House is downplaying the role of far-right activists in terrorism in the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, I think that everyone's been in denial about it. I think it's not just conservatives. I think people on the left have not been cognizant of it, partly because we're kind of in denial about the ongoing existence of the extremist right in this country. And it really kind of took Charlottesville to wake everybody up to the reality that no, people, this is real and it's here and it's a problem. And we need to do something about it. We need to take it seriously. You know, these right-wing extremists are fundamentally anti-democratic. Everything about them is anti-democratic. They're hostile to civil rights. They're hostile to all of these basic institutions of democracy, including the right to vote. And you know, they want to displace democracy with a fundamentally authoritarian state. These people are right-wing authoritarians. And that's the phenomenon that we're really not confronting or dealing with in any kind of adequate fashion at all. And, you know, people need to understand it's democracy is only as strong as we make it. It's not going to just automatically be around forever, especially when it's under specific attack, as it is now. These movements are specifically out to attack our democratic institutions. And if we want to preserve them, then we need to defend them. We need to stand up for them.
When the Congresswoman Gabby Giffords was shot and several other people were murdered at a constituents meeting in Arizona a few years ago, you say that the right-wing connection to that murder was downplayed. Is that right?
Well, sure. Not only, I mean, everyone attacked anyone who, initially there was some pushback. When Giffords was shot, people stood up and said, see, this is what happens when you have all this demonizing rhetoric. There had been all this rhetoric that had been aimed at Giffords particularly. You know, our opponent had hosted a party where a fundraising event where you could go out to the gun range and shoot Gabby Giffords targets. You know, that was part of the whole environment in which this all occurred. And it's true that Jared Lochner, the man who committed the killings, is mentally ill. It's true that his ideology was actually very idiosyncratic. But he also was, there's no question that he had absorbed all of these, a lot of this far right wing hatred directed towards Giffords over these years. And he was acting on that.
Has the Department of Homeland Security, has anybody raised the warning flag to say that this right-wing violence is on the rise and it's something to be taken seriously and we should do something about it?
Sure. Well, in 2009, Department of Homeland Security issued a bulletin that went out to law enforcement agencies around the country warning them to be aware that right-wing extremists were stepping up their activities, their organizing, and their recruitment, and to be aware that, you know, because the people who are actually most on the front line in confronting right-wing extremists are our law enforcement officers. One of the things that, of course, is most aggravating about the wild overreaction to Black Lives Matter to me and the, you know, formation of the Blue Lives Matter movement, as they call themselves, is the fact that you know, I've been dealing with law enforcement for 20 years in trying to help them prepare for the very deadly confrontations that can happen for them when they deal with sovereign citizens. the very far right extremist belief system, that these people, these sovereign citizens, are very much part of this same far right extremist worldview that I'm describing in Alt America. And there is a very long track record of dozens and dozens of police officers being gunned down by sovereign citizens in the country. You know, I mean, just this last summer, a sheriff's deputy in Montana was gunned down in cold blood by two sovereign citizens who then went on a cross-state chase, a high-speed chase across the state, and were finally caught 100 miles away from where the shooting occurred. And did any of that make it into the press? Was Blue Lives Matter involved in that? Were any of the people who were outraged over Black Lives Matter or the supposed deaths of police officers outraged over that? No, they weren't, because they don't pay any attention to it. They don't count that as an actual act of domestic terrorism, which it is.
When this official from the Department of Homeland Security issues the warning, how was it taken by the media? What was the response?
Well, in fact, it got shouted down. There was a huge media unpleasant storm, shall we call it? There was a huge media firestorm over that whole bulletin, largely because people like Michelle Malkin and then Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly got a hold of it and said, "Oh my God, they're targeting right wing, or they're targeting mainstream conservatives with this bulletin," which is, you know, really very weird, because the bulletin actually was very specific in that it said it was concerned about neo-Nazis and other far right, extreme far right elements, specifically recruiting veterans and taking advantage of issues such as abortion and things like that as recruitment strategies. And this was instead, the whole thing got blown up as, well, you're attacking conservatives. And eventually, not only did DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano wind up apologizing for the bulletin and withdrawing it, they also gutted that entire office that was devoted to monitoring right-wing extremists and reduced it to a single person.
We're talking with David Nywert. The book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right and the Age of Trump. You talk about things that help drive this movement, this alt-right movement, conspiracy theories, paranoia, fake news. They all help make this movement grow. How so?
Well, they create this epistemological bubble that people can sort of escape the reality with, you know, because a lot of the things that they argue are just risibly and provably false and untrue. You know, just some of it's even laughable. Some of the stuff that they believe, including such conspiracy theories as the Pizzagate theory and the pedophilia sex ring on Mars theory. You know,
on Mars? No, seriously.
Yeah, that was what one of the things that Alex Jones was proposing, or was telling people, was that there was actually these secret missions to Mars where the pedophilia sex rings were taking kids. I'm not kidding you.
So you
can look it up.
But chemtrails, 9/11, all these conspiracy theories, FEMA concentration camps. All this is important to the rise of this movement.
Yeah, well, it creates this sort of alternative reality where people can believe these things. And you know, the key thing is that it discounts, it demolishes sort of your traditional authorities, such as mainstream media, such as standard reportage, from what we know to be true and what is not true. Instead, it replaces them with, you know, wild speculation and innuendo and things like that. And that has a lot to do with the way that the radical right has always operated. Hitler relied on these conspiracy theories about Jews and the protocols of the Seven Elders of Zion back in the 1920s and 30s to whip up hate against Jews. And it's very much part of their sort of world. It actually has a lot to do with the psychology of right-wing authoritarianism and how it works psychologically. But it's the appeal of conspiracy theories are extremely important to drawing people into this world in which they operate. And a lot of it has to do, I mean, let's be honest, really white supremacy, if you look at it logically and rationally and using facts and logic and reason, it's almost a joke of an ideology, because none of its actual tenets stand up to any kind of serious factual scrutiny. And so that's why they have to create this epistemological bubble in order to protect it, because they want people to be able to discard facts and logic and reason when they're looking at their movement.
So some of these conspiracy theories and the paranoia harkens back to the John Birch Society. I remember paying attention to the John Birch Society of the 1960s, and the government's going to come and get your guns, and it's poisoning everybody to make them more compliant so the communists can take over. And everything about sex was a way to undermine the morality of the country and make it easier for the communists to take over. When the guns weren't taken in the 1960s...
Purity of essence, Mandrake.
Exactly. It's Dr. Strangelove. But, you know, even when President Obama was in office, there were theories that I got every day from our conservative listeners, far-right conservative listeners, who said that President Obama is going to take all of our guns and put us, round us up using the UN and take us to FEMA concentration camps, take the conservatives to FEMA concentration camps. It never happened. It didn't happen in the 1960s. It didn't happen in the 19 under President Obama. What happens when the conspiracy theory doesn't turn out to be true?
Well, they don't care. They never have. That's the thing. This is something I discovered a long time ago. Yeah, I grew up in southern Idaho, where the Birch Society ruled in the 1960s. And it was very much part of the air that I breathed when I was growing up. And yeah, you figure out after a while that, you know, none of these warnings ever come true. None of the fears or paranoias that they're whipping up ever come true, because it's all just fantasy. But they just keep spinning new versions. Look, one of the things about them is that they create this prism of sorts that you can, through which you can view each day's news events. So each day they look at every news event through the prism of their belief system, and it provides them with yet new fodder for their beliefs that, the stuff with Roy Moore is certain proof of the nefarious media conspiracy to destroy conservatives, and so on and so forth. Every day they're able to translate it through. And so this is how they keep operating. And yeah, and they always forget that, you know, their warnings never, ever come true. Look, I can tell you, I can pull out stuff that John Trockman from the militia of Montana created back in 1993 and 94, warning people about FEMA concentration camps. And that's actually the origin for that whole conspiracy theory. It was back in the 90s with the militias. And of course, they were warning that this was happening any day now. The black helicopters are going to be swooping conservatives and gun owners away and putting them in concentration camps. And it, you know, obviously never happened and never does. And that, you know, I actually, just for fun on Facebook the other day, I got into a conversation with one of these true believers. And I just said, and he was an older guy and he'd been around this stuff for a long time. And I just said, I asked him, have you been around? I've been around this stuff for a long time, and none of this stuff is, you know, I've been hearing these theories since I was a little kid, and none of them ever come true. And I said, isn't there a point at which you realize you're being played, that you're being suckered? Isn't there a point where you wake up and understand that you're being had? And he didn't respond.
So. Well, I think the best time to buy gun stock is at the beginning of any Democratic administration, because you know that the gun theories, the gun confiscation yeah. theories, are going to erupt right after a Democrat's elected president.
And ammunition makers, too.
So in the 1960s, William F. Buckley, who was the founder of, I believe it was the National Review, wrote several important books on the conservative side of the spectrum. He stood up to the conspiracy theorists in the John Birch Society. But is there anybody today in the conservative side saying, you know, you guys have gone too far off the cliff, you got to get back into reality? Is there any conservative out there who's doing what Buckley did in the 60s?
Well, there are a few, but they're mostly being thrown over the cliff. You know, Jeff Flake did his thing in the Senate recently, where he tried to stand up to these elements. And Flake's, you know, obviously not an ideal model, because he actually votes with Trump, you know, 90% of the time. But he's still concerned about, you know, the sanity of the mainstream Republican Party, as well he should. And there are a few others, you know. There's former campaign manager for John McCain named Rick Schmidt, who's also been out there on the front trying to talk sense into Republicans. But all of those folks are just being pretty much plowed under. So I don't see anybody with any effectiveness standing up to this bus careering right over the cliff and into the abyss.
The New York Times had to apologize for an article that it carried over the weekend on Saturday, depicting the life of a neo-Nazi outside of Dayton, Ohio, in Huber Heights, Ohio, in which it talked a lot about you know, the guy's reading habits and his cooking habits and his wife. What did you make of that article and the apology afterwards?
Well, it was a well-intended piece. Look, one of the realities of dealing with right-wing extremists is that they are human beings. They're actually, most of the time, they're normal people. They don't have horns on their heads. They blend in with the rest of us. You know, I mean, heck, George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated while doing his laundry at a laundromat. You know, I mean, they've always been normal people, or blend in with us.
We should say that he led the Nazis in the 1960s, the American Nazis in the 1960s. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so, I mean, it's just always been sort of part of the deal when dealing with them. And you know, I started out actually, in my first encounter was in my very first newspaper job in the late 1970s. I was the editor of a very tiny daily in Sandpoint, Idaho, which was about 20 miles north of where the Aryan Nations compound was located. So I had to deal with this element very early on. And I made a mistake. You know, we sat down and they were just starting to recruit and make their presence felt in northern Idaho at the time. And we thought, these guys just want attention. So let's not give them any. Let's not give them any publicity. We'll just ignore them and pretend they're not there and give them as little coverage as we possibly can. And within a few years, you know, that whole region was awash in this tide of hate crimes and really ugly incidents. You had people, you know, mixed race families were being harassed by these neo-Nazis in their homes, and you know, Jewish businesses were being vandalized, that sort of thing. So and it culminated, you know, in 1984 with the multi-state crime rampage of an outfit out of the Aryan Nations called The Order, which went around and I think they robbed some 25 or so banks and armored cars, and also assassinated a radio talk show host in Denver named Ellen Berg. And so, yeah, it was, by then it was pretty obvious, you know, that sort of approach, pretending they're not there, it wasn't going to work.
Was it really a big mistake? Was the New York Times normalizing Nazis by profiling this guy in outside of Dayton on the weekend?
Well, and that's the risk you run. Once we started writing about him, it was a realization that, you know, if you're going to shine a light on him, you have to do it in full context. Otherwise, you run the risk of making them appear normal, because honestly, for the most part, they do appear normal. And one of the things that I think was really overlooked as well in the reaction to the Times story was the fact that what people were most uncomfortable about is the fact that he does blend in so easily. And that's talks more about how many white people are like this, are thinking like this now. And that has a lot to do with Fox News and mainstream conservatism. The fact that they have gone so far to the right now that it's not a very far step for you to reach over and become a white nationalist. And that's, I think, the sort of factor that nobody really wants to talk about when they think about that New York Times piece. I think the New York Times piece was unfortunately really lacking in context. The reporter who did the piece clearly didn't seem to understand that right-wing extremists talk in a kind of code that reflects the alternative universe that they live in. It's a form of language that's, you know, directed at people who live within that universe. So he would say, you know, the guy in the Times piece often was quoted saying things that someone who's knowledgeable about the subject would recognize as, this is actually the coded speech. And what the Times reporter really needed to do was explain to an average reader what that coded speech really means. He made a lot of oblique references to Holocaust denial in his quotes, but the reporter didn't explain that to people. And there were a lot of other similar references like that. So, like I say, context is everything. And it's also important to give readers the historical context of how long these beliefs have been around, where they're bubbling up from, and why they're bubbling up now. And the story utterly failed to do that. And so as a result, it wound up being a puff piece that made them look normal. And that's the last thing you want to be doing.
Hmm. Are these radical right-wing groups on the rise, groups like the militia movement and Nazis and Christian Identity and white nationalists, are they on the upswing now?
Yes. Yes, they are. We're definitely seeing huge shifts in recruitment. That's a lot of why I wrote this book, was that, you know, I got to tell you, Rob, I wanted to write a book about humpback whales for the last 2 years. Because
you're up there in Seattle.
Yeah, and I did a book about killer whales that sold 10 times more than any of my books about hate crimes and hate groups ever did. So, you know, it was a lot of fun to do it. And honestly, I was kind of hopeful that these movements were starting to fade enough that, you know, I'm nearing retirement age, and I was kind of hoping that I'd be able to ride off into the sunset on the back of some whales or something.
but these groups are on the rise.
But Donald Trump came along, and it became really obvious that we were seeing really large recruitment numbers and increasing numbers of people being drawn into this. And I think the most disturbing aspect were the large audience numbers we were seeing on the internet for some of these hate sites, particularly places like the Daily Stormer, which is an alt-right 1488er, that is a neo-Nazi website. And it's possibly the most vile stuff I've ever seen in all my years of covering these guys. I mean, the far right has always been good at coming up with vile stuff, but oh my gosh, the stuff that they publish at the Stormer is just, in their comments section is just, it's the most, you feel like you need to go into a hazmat tank after wading through it.
Hmm. Well, I want to get back to the ultimate aim of these groups. You write at one point, among other pathologies, many alt-Americans freely fantasize in print and on YouTube about their desire to execute liberals, terrorists, race mixers, and other traitors. That's scary stuff.
Yeah, now we can also add to that anybody who criticizes Trump, because they definitely are now fantasizing about assassinating those people. And so, yeah, it's the disturbing thing to me, and what I'm most concerned about, and this is what I've said all along, this is what I actually sold the book to the publishers on the basis of, is we were selling this thing in the summer of 2016, and all of the major houses that we talked to said, well, this story will be dead by next year. and so Verso wound up being very happy they picked it up. But my argument, counter-argument back, was that even if Trump disappears tomorrow, the army of followers that he has raised will be with us for a very long time. And that's going to be a systemic problem for us for a long time to come. And we need to think about how we're going to be handling that. How do we deal with that? And then, of course, when he actually won, then the trouble became tenfold. So even if Trump were to be, say, Bob Mueller comes down with indictments and he's impeached within a matter of months and removed from office and so on and so forth, I'm really concerned about what will happen among these very heavily armed, very angry, very paranoid, and frankly, lunatic followers that he has raised. I'm afraid there's going to be a wave of domestic terrorism if there is any attempt to remove Trump from office. And I'm afraid there's going to be domestic terrorism associated with, if he survives, with the 2020 campaign.
Did they threaten a civil war if Hillary Clinton won?
Yes, they did. They were vowing to go into civil war. And in fact, one of the cases of domestic terrorism that I talk about in my reveal piece was the arrest in October of 2016 of three men in Kansas who were plotting to use Timothy McVeigh-style truck bombs. They had actually assembled the materials to do this with, including the fertilizer and the fuel oil and the fuses and all this kind of stuff. They were going to attack, they were going to use these truck bombs at a Muslim community, people mostly from, was it Ethiopia? No. At any rate, they were going to attack a Muslim community with these truck bombs, three of them. They were going to set them off at places that would have inflicted mass casualties, probably close to 1,000 people. And then they were going to park themselves at the gateways to this community and with guns and mow down anybody who tried to leave. So there were going to be mass casualties if this event had taken place. They were planning this to take place the day after the election because they were expecting Hillary Clinton to win. So
we're talking with Dave Neiwirth. He's a journalist, an author, and an expert in American right-wing extremism. He's the Pacific Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. His new book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. So there's a big debate about how to deal with these far-right groups. Do you confront them and stop them from growing now? Do you ignore them and have events across town when they come to your town? What's your take on how best to stand up to this wave of racist nationalism?
Oh, it's a really tricky. It's really tricky. I don't know. I don't claim to have the answers on that. I do think that there is a level at which they need to know that people disapprove of them. So, you know, the SPLC strongly recommends that people use counter events held at separate places that can send the message that the community disapproves of them without having the risk of physical confrontations with them. Partly because what right-wing extremists always do, particularly at sort of this phase of their development, which is the power acquisition phase, is that they always try to make themselves out to be martyrs. They try to make themselves appear to be victims of left-wing violence. And so they've been very successful at doing that in, you know, in the past 8 months, thanks mainly to, you know, the Black Bloc folks coming out and being assaultive at their events. And I've covered a number of these events. I was at the January 20th event in Seattle when a man was shot and I was about 10 feet away from him. A Black Bloc, well, I should say an anti-fascist was shot by one of the alt-righters at that event. And yeah, and the press ignored that case as well.
What happened to the man who was shot?
He's fine now. He had a bullet in his spine, was in the hospital for 2 months. But I just had coffee with him the other day. So he's recovering okay. Again, it's one of those things where if that had been an anarchist who'd shot somebody, you know that would have been in the press. Mm-hmm. You know it would have been a big stinking deal. And I, you know, I went down and covered the big, it really turned into a riot in Berkeley in April when it really became quite violent. And that was, you know, that was both sides as far as I was concerned. Everything I was seeing was that both sides were there for a fight and they both got it. You know, I didn't blame that on the anti-fascists, and it was the alt-righters who set the thing up they basically set the whole demonstration up as a troll, you know. And this is what they've been doing, is they basically have been trolling the anti-fascists and setting them up with these rallies where they're basically saying, come punch me so we can make you look bad and make ourselves look good. And the anti-fascists have been finally figuring it out and not giving them the violence that they want, and instead just demonstrating peacefully and loudly, which is, I think, you know, if you're going to demonstrate against them, that's what you have to do. It absolutely has to be disciplined, because a single moment of failure discipline will give them the fuel they need to promote themselves. Actually, I have to say the very best anti-fascist rally I've ever attended was one that happened back in 2006 when a group out of Portland came up to Olympia and held a neo-Nazi rally on the steps of the state capitol. They were all wearing brown shirts and swastika armbands and the whole nine yards. And the counter-demonstrators that day came out dressed in clown outfits and Groucho masks and had signs, wave signs making fun of them, and performed skits and basically sat and mooned these guys all day, right? And it was the funniest dang thing I ever saw. It was also the most effective. The neo-Nazis were just apoplectic with rage. They were humiliated, and they sat there popping veins and raging at the counter-demonstrators on the other side, clearly unhappy. And everybody went home that day. You know, the cops had smiles on their faces. The demonstrators had smiles on their faces. And everybody except the Nazis had smiles on their faces at the end of the day. And they went home, and within the year, that particular neo-Nazi organization had fallen apart and broken up. So I think if you're going to confront them, make fun of them, humiliate them, because that's what they can't take. And otherwise, you know, I think if you're going to, I think the counter-demonstration elsewhere, physically separated from their presence, is actually a very good route as well.
David, is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I just think it's important to understand the demonstrations really are just street theater. What happened in Charlottesville ultimately was sort of a street theater. And these are just sort of the tip of the iceberg of what's going on in a much bigger way underneath. And so as much as I think it's interesting to focus on and think about what happens at these demonstrations, I don't think that that's where the fight really lays. I think the fight lays in our homes, in our personal lives, across our Thanksgiving dinner tables or holiday dinner tables, as well as, you know, our business dealings and how we deal with things in real life, as well as at the voting booth. Ultimately, this, as I said, is a profoundly anti-democratic movement, and I think it can only be answered and adequately addressed through democracy, through using the levers of democracy. We desperately need to revive the values of democracy in this country in a way that refutes and repudiates these movements and drives them back into the shadows where they belong.
Well, David Nyward, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. The book is Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. David, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to comment about this show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11. I'm Rob Lori. This is